Please welcome in our new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. Go to underdogfantasy.com and you'll discover that Underdog Fantasy is the best and easiest place to play fantasy sports. Underdog Fantasy lets you draft a fantasy dream team in minutes. Sign up now with the code POWERTRIP and you'll double your first deposit up to $100 in bonus cash when you make your first deposit of $10 or more. That's right, deposit $100 and get $100 for free. Underdog keeps it simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between 2 and 5 players to fill out your pick'em slip, get every pick right, and take home some cold, hard cash. Use that promo code POWERTRIP and get your first deposit doubled up by $100 by Underdog. That's underdogfantasy.com. Use the promo code POWERTRIP today.
The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
What's up, guys? It's the phenomenal AJ Styles. You're listening to the two-man power trip.
Hey, Johnny. Cool, man. What's going on? We ready to go or what?
Welcome to the two-man power trip of wrestling. I am your host, JP John Paz. With me today, a very special guest. He was the WCW ring announcer all the way till the end. He is Mr. David Penger. David, welcome back to two-man power trip. How you doing?
Thanks, John. Back where it all started. I think you were the first. We're talking before you hit record. You were the first one to put me on a podcast and interview me. And look what's happened since then. I had my own podcast for 4 years. Right. It's all because of you, man.
Pretty amazing. If you really look back and you think about it, it's like, wow, a lot has happened since then. God, that had been 7-8 years ago now. But yeah, that was a long time. Obviously, the podcast very successful. But tell us about the book.
The book came about. I had saved a whole bunch of really cool, super rare formats and internal memos when I was in WCW. I basically hoarded everything I had, and I kept them in a folder in my desk. And one day, you know, last year, the real estate market was slow. I'm a realtor. And so I found them and I started thinking, how could I monetize these? You know, hey, I want people, but I'd like to, you know, be able to monetize it a little bit. And so I took a picture of like one of the Saturday night formats and put it on Twitter and said, who would like to see these? And, you know, a lot of people reacted. And Guy Evans, who I had talked to when he was writing the Nitro book, reached out and said, man, we should do a scrapbook. I said, well, if you think that's the best way to monetize it and get it out there, that's fine. So we're just, the whole plan was to put those formats out. And, you know, I was going to tell some stories about, you know, the guys I work with that were in the formats. And we're about, I don't know, got halfway through and guys called me and said, we're doing 2 books. And I said, well, we're already doing volume 2. You're putting them both together? He said, no, we're doing a scrapbook, like we said, with all those formats and cool memos, including the last Nitro which I don't think has ever been available before. You know, everybody, if I didn't have it, I probably would wonder, you know, how much of the Vince and Shane stuff was on the Nitro format. So, you know, for those who might have wondered, now you're going to get to see. The answer is there's some stuff on there. So it's not like it was kayfabe, the whole thing. He said, we're going to do an autobiography. I said, I don't know. Do you think somebody wants to read about my life and journey? And he said, man, he said, I'm just amazed by it. He said, it's like incredible. And I'm like, are you sure? He said, I said, we're still going to show sell the bonus stuff, right? He goes, yeah, it'll be two books in one. So here we are. And he did a great job telling my story. The book is called Sitting Ringside, Volume 1. And for the set one price, you get my autobiography and my story. Lots of things about WCW. It ends, begins in my childhood and ends when WCW went out of business, and my memories of everything in between. We don't focus on my life and basically get to the wrestling part pretty quick. And, you know, just so many, you know, this was 1980s something, late 80s. You know, a guy just didn't, you know, that had no wrestling experience, no athletic ability part, didn't just come in and go backstage at the WCW show and start, you know, talking to the Rock and Roll Express and Junkyard Dog. Just so many things had to go right for it to happen. It was my dream always, but it was almost the impossible to coin, you know, not to steal a phrase, but, you know, so many things had to happen right. And, you know, the whole thing was really like therapy for me. Telling him all this stuff, and I'm figuring out in my head, like I would say, like, I don't know why this didn't happen. I don't know. And then I'd talk it through it with him, and it'd be like, oh my God, this is like therapy. Now I realize why. You know, for example, Bob Roop is the first person to really bring me into the business in a big way, and then he handed me off to Jody Hamilton, which he didn't have to do, CW, and you know. We never really remained close at all. He was at my wedding, and we were very close at one point. And I won't spoil it for you, but in talking through it with Guy, he was my therapist, and I was able to figure out why we were close. And a couple of scenarios like that. But it's about my journey in WCW, my memories. We talk a lot about, you know, obviously the Monday Night Wars, and you know. The memories of what went on behind the scenes and some fun stories, a lot never before told. Go from there until it pretty much ends when I was walking out the office with my box full of stuff. After I went through security when WWE took over the company and came to the power plant and kicked us all out, shut off all our computers and laptops and all that. And that's a bit, Guy does a great job making it even more entertaining than it probably is. And you got the formats and stuff to boot. So I'm really excited about it. And never in a million years would I have thought I was going to write an autobiography. People would ask me a lot, you know, especially this last run with Impact. You know, I'd be going to the car with the, you know, to the car. And, you know, some of the fans would say, hey, you're going to write a book? And I was like, no, nobody wants to read my book. But Guy brought out of me the best stories, and the way he puts it is so entertaining. I'm really happy with it, and I think the fans are going to love it, and I think the fans will love the formats. And if you go to David Penzer book, allonword.com, you could get the book. You could also get different packages with where you could actually have some of the formats. We'll print them out and send them to you. And you know, might be cool to have the last Nitro format go to fan conventions and, you know, have guys like Ric Flair and Tony Schiavone sign the last Nitro format. So so that's about it. And looking forward to talking to you about how things have been going and the crazy wrestling business that we're in right now.
Oh, yes. Now, the book looks awesome. I love the format. It's insane to think, like, wow, actually kept the formats, because that is so cool. And I feel like so many people probably have never even seen a wrestling format. You know what I mean? Like, I think that's awesome that you were able to not only keep them, but I mean, kind of preserve history there.
Well, you know, for people that grew up watching Worldwide and WCW Saturday Night, it's how the sausage was made. You know what I mean? So I just think it's a really, you know, in the last night show, how the sausage was made, but that one's more rare because of its historical perspective. But some of the Saturday night and worldwide ones are just as cool, you know, just not from a historical perspective, but just seeing how the sausage was made. So yeah, I'm glad I hung on to him. A little bit of a hoarder myself. So I guess in this way, it ended up being a good thing.
It's funny too, because on the thing for sitting ringside, Kevin Sullivan, who does the forward, says you were the least likely person to succeed in the business. Not taking a shot though, right? I mean, he's being genuine there.
No, it's true. And that's part of the story that's incredible is I didn't have a chance. I mean, you got to remember, like I said, it was 1989. The things like this didn't happen. We live in a world now where if you want to be a ring announcer, you could be a ring announcer at your local indie shows. Probably they won't pay you anything at first, and then they might pay you a little bit. And then, you know, you could try to climb up the ladder. It's a crowded ladder for sure, but it doesn't hurt to try. But at least there's the opportunity. It wasn't an opportunity back then. So many things had to go right. That really shouldn't have gone right. It's incredible and so well written by Guy. And as you can tell, I'm excited by it. So go to davidpenzerbook.com. I just did another interview before this one, and I texted Guy and he said, "How'd it go?" I said, "I think I promoted the book too much." He said, "No, that's impossible." So I'll probably promote it a lot. But yeah, super excited about it. It's also available on Amazon, free shipping on both sites.
When you look back, right, when you first got in, were you ever planning on staying in the business, or was it just going to be, you know, a short-term thing just for a little bit of money? And like, did you ever plan on actually making a living in wrestling?
I was on a ride that never should have started, but luckily it did. And I was going to that ride as far as it took me, whether it was doing indie shows with Bob Roop with the ring we bought from the Global Wrestling Alliance, whether it was, you know, driving guys up to the TV tapings and getting $25 a guy and WCW paid for my rental van and gas, I was going to ride it as far as I could. In a million years, I could have never imagined that 30 years later, I'd be still be doing this and talking about it. And, you know, up until the end of last year, you know, I had a good run with Impact. And so it's so highly unlikely. And it's one of the interesting parts of the book. You know, there's some cool things about behind the scenes in WCW and hanging out in the announcer's trailer with, like, if you look back, probably one of the absolute best announced team in the history of any company in professional wrestling, probably never to be outdone. You know, Bobby Heenan, Mike Tenay, Mean Gene Okerlund, Tony Schiavone, Larry Zbysko, then you had Scott Hudson. And I mean, it's just, and I got to be a fly on the wall to listen to them tell stories and rib each other. And you know, there's a part in the story where, you know, when I was flunking out of college, I used to go with my friend Jeff, and we would watch Tuesday Night Titans. You remember that show?
Oh yeah. Yep.
It was like a talk show, a wrestling talk show. And we would get stoned, which back then wasn't as big, was much bigger deal than it is now saying on the air. But the crazy part is since then I smoked it. Now that it's legal, I don't smoke it. And we would sit there and say, man, if only there's some way that we could find a way, if I could have a drink with like one person and have a brief conversation over a cocktail, it'd be Bobby the Brain Heenan. And to think that years later, he came to my birthday party we both considered each other good friends. I got to meet his family. He got to know mine. It's just unbelievable. It's a fairy tale in a lot of ways. Yeah, it just shows that if you have the will and the hard work, desire to do something, and you catch a bunch of lucky breaks, then because it's crazy looking back that 30 years later and here I am.
So who officially hired you into WCW? Was it Bischoff or was it Jody?
Well, I was never really hired until I became the backup ring announcer. I was just... You know, Jody had a thing that preceded him that Gene Anderson used to do. So he'd get, you know, he was in charge of the enhancement guys. So he'd get, say, Rip Rogers in, Cincinnati area. He'd have Italian Stallion and George South in Mid-Atlantic. He'd have Mike Jackson in Alabama. And they would do the same thing. They'd pay for the rental car. He would... whoever the talent was would book a bunch of guys he had confidence in that could do a good job putting guys over. And you know, not only would they wrestle like a Rip Rogers wrestle and get paid, but they'd get $25 from each of the other guy. They'd get their car gone. And so when Bob Roop went up there for his short stint as a road agent with Ole Anderson, I asked him, you know, hey, see if you could put in a good word, never in a million years thinking that, that he was going to do it. I remember back then, and even now, you put in a good word for somebody and they end up screwing up, it could be your ass on the line too. But, he handed me off to Jody, and Jody said, look, you know, I know you don't wrestle, but we'll rent you a truck and a van and pay for your gas, and the guys will each give you $25. And I drove across the whole state of Florida, across, up, and across back, and every week. And I was just going to keep going. I was going to keep coming. They told me not to. They never told me not to. And then I got the opportunity to compete for the backup ring announcer, and the rest is history. And I actually took a pay cut. It's in the book, the specific amounts. But I actually took a pay cut to become the ring.
Wow, that's crazy to think, because you're actually going to be on TV, you're going to be ring announcing, and it's technically a pay cut, I guess, because all that extra money driving around, I guess it adds up.
Yeah, well, back then we had, at first it was just one night and back, so we would just drive up, drive back, and take turns driving. Then it was two nights, so it was double pay. And then I got some other, I don't want to give away too much of the story, it's in the book, but I got some other people, their areas involved, and got $10 of their $25. And, you know, we'd go to Disney for a week, and all that money adds up. So when they told me how much they were going to pay me, which probably will shock people, to be the ring announcer, WCW propensity to spend money. It was a pay cut, but, you know, it was an opportunity that, you know, look what happened. I couldn't never have imagined, like I said.
The ATM Eric thing maybe is a false narrative, I guess.
Well, I was an employee, a Turner employee, and it wasn't of my choosing. So I didn't really have a contract that came up for renewal. I got cost of living. I got raises when I hit certain years. And really the cool thing about it was, you know, I never had a conversation with ATM Eric about my money, although it, as you'll see in the book, he did help me out on one particular important situation. But it really worked out at the end, because even though I might not have made the big money if I wasn't an employee and was under a talent contract, when the company went out of business, you got a salary every month, every year you worked there, you got a month's salary and benefits. So I had 8 months to figure out what I was doing with my life after this whole thing went south. And, you know, that, in hindsight saved me. I had a wife and kids. My wife wasn't working at the time. She was raising the kids. And so, you know, if I hadn't had that, I don't know what the end of the story would have been, but it wouldn't have been what it is now.
I think everybody remembers your tuxedo and the colorful, the cummerbund, if you will. Where did the idea come from? Did you want to stand out? Was it expensive?
I wasn't cheap, but it wasn't expensive. I think they were like $25 back in the day. And, you know, over the years, I accumulated a bunch. It was different places. But, I wore the same thing every night. You know, Ric Flair is in a mood. He wants to wear a red robe and white tights and white boots. He could do that. If he wants to wear a robe and yellow, tights and yellow boots, he could do that. I wore the same thing. So for me, it was just, and there wasn't any rhyme or reason to it. I just grabbed like three or four and whatever I felt like wearing when I got dressed that night, whatever mood I was in, I just throw it on. Just, I wasn't really never to stand out like to the audience. For me, it was just showing my, a little bit of my, my personality.
When that thing happens with Jericho, that great feud, obviously he destroys your tuxedo at one point, then he apologizes, then he flips out and he snaps again because he lost, and he's doing that whole crybaby thing. Is that like a scripted thing, or is that between you and Jericho and you guys are kind of just doing that on your own?
No, Terry Taylor was involved in that. Terry was a big fan of Chris's, and Chris wanted to turn heel. He came up with most of it. Terry, you know, approved it. And would throw in things. And, you know, I might throw in a quick idea here and there, but I'm certainly not any credit for that. But it was fun to be able to have a little bit of creativity, just even if it's just a little say here and there. Jericho is so talented. And you know, it's just, it's the nuances. It's the small that people don't think of. If you go back to that whole period, so he would take my chair and he'd beat it up against the ring post, and then he'd rip my tuxedo off. And then the next week he'd bring me a new tuxedo jacket, which makes sense. But he'd bring me a chair in a building, 5,000 chairs. I didn't need him to bring me back a chair, but it's just that if you go back and look at anything that he does, it's a small nuanced stuff that he comes up with that just takes it to a different level. And I was really lucky to be involved in that. That gave me TV time, and I wasn't looking for it, but I was happy to do it and happy to help a friend who I consider still a friend. And I look forward to him reading my book.
With him, you're right. Those little things that he would do, like we've never seen somebody do that before, where they like throw a temper tantrum, but then they apologize, and then they throw another temper tantrum and they ruin your jacket again. It was just so creative and so out of the box and so different. It's like, wow, this guy really is like a crybaby, but like you almost have to laugh at that because he's such a good heel.
Well, think about the You're on the List, Jericho. It wasn't just that you're on the list. It was the clicking of the pen. You know, that's part of the gimmick, the clicking of the pen. You're on the list. I mean, it's such the small things that most people don't even think of that really gets it over. And I mean, I know we're here to talk about me, but anytime I could put over Chris Jericho, I mean, he's so talented and probably the greatest of all time at recreating themselves with so many different entertaining characters. I don't think there's ever been anybody better. Is he the best draw in the history of the business? No. Is he the best technical wrestler? He's up there. But as far as creating so many different entertaining and money drawing characters, I don't think there's anybody that comes close.
And so good character wise, just like what he's able to do, like you were saying, like the nuances, but just his promos, just the little things with his characters. Even in WCW, when he was that corny baby face, he'd put his back into the crowd and he would go, "Yeah, baby," and he'd like pump his fist, like stuff like that. You just notice and remember, be like, this guy's corny, but I really like this guy. He just has some sort of knack for wrestling.
Well, he's a charismatic guy. He's a fun guy. He's a nice guy. I think people pick up on that. Some, you know, the best stuff of in wrestling is the organic stuff that isn't booked by the booker or the team. It's just the stuff that the people pick up on that gets over. Like, for example, Rusev Day comes to mind. So stuff like that's organic. That's my favorite stuff. The bloodline stuff. I started watching the bloodline angles just because, if you remember correctly, Jey Uso couldn't stop laughing during a segment and viral. And I saw it on Twitter. So I didn't even watch WWE at the time, but I was like, well, this looks sort of fun. So I DVR'd SmackDown and I watched it again. And to this day, I'm an avid follower of the bloodline. I look to it every week or 2 weeks whenever Roman's there or Paul Heyman, and the payoff at WrestleMania was great, and with what's been going on lately, I'm curious to see where they go from here. And as I say in the book, for me it was always about, from the time I was 11 years old, it was always about the angles and the promos. Yeah, I like the matches. But for me, it was always about the angles and the promos. It fascinated me. And then almost 40 years later, it's still 50 years later, it still fascinates me to this day. I've been such a lucky person and lived my dream. And you could read all about it going to davidpenzerbook.com.
Yes, can't promote it enough. But you're right, though. The angles, the promos, that's what kind of hooks you. The story kind of gets you wanting to tune in every week. Yeah, you can watch a good match. Or, yeah, those great matches, they come. But those stories, they keep you coming along. They really keep it going for you. And the bloodline angle is great.
Yeah. No, it's incredible. I'm a big fan. Maybe I'll go on a limb and say maybe the best angle for its longevity in the history of the wrestling business. That's saying wow. something. Think how long it's gone on for, and you don't even know where it's going. You know, you got Solo and his sidekick now, and Heyman's doing a tremendous job of being horrified by that, which really makes me wonder where it's going to go. One of it, if you don't know, a lot of stuff in wrestling, is given away. And I understand there's a business there that people make money by giving behind the scenes information. But, I always think that the most fun is when you don't know. TNA did Rebellion this weekend, and, they did a promotion where who's going to be in the ring when the lights go out. And earlier in the show, in the semi-main, they had the lights go out, as you probably know, and Sami Callihan was there. And, big return. Sammy's really popular there. It was kind of when he left. So you're thinking, okay, that's the lights went out. Sami Callihan's back. And you don't even really think anything of it. And then after the main event, the lights go out again and broken Matt Hardy. Holy crap. I mean, if that had gotten out before, I mean, that would have been such a letdown. But I think about Jordynne Grace. Imagine if she'd have came out in the Royal Rumble and nobody knew about it. As good as the whole freaking thing was, and as much as it got, imagine if nobody knew about it. It's just, I understand. Like I said, I understand there's a business of giving the secrets away. It's always been around, but it's maybe too available if you get my drift.
Yeah, I actually try to avoid some of that stuff, especially if I want to enjoy the show, because sometimes that could take away from the show. Like, you want to be surprised. You don't want to know what happens next.
I will tell you, with all the time I was with Impact Wrestling, that's how tight this company is as far as being a family. Not one time for 3 years with Impact Wrestling. And look, spoilers get out now because they're taping TV in front of the fans again. It's not live. So obviously they're going to get out. You could see everything, all the matches that happened the second night where they taped 2 weeks of TV in Vegas the other night. But when we were doing it in the empty arena in Nashville, not one spoiler got out about anything. Not one time in 3 years, other than when we went back in front of the fans and we weren't live. But other than that, whenever we were live or we were in front of no fans, not one spoiler ever got out, which is a real testament to that company and the believing in it and loving it and loving each other. And if you don't watch TNA, formerly Impact Wrestling, formerly TNA, I can't say enough about the product. I wish Scott was still there, but that's out of my control, obviously. But it's still a great. And if you don't check it out, I suggest checking it out. And when you do that, you can check out davidpenzerbook.com.
Yes.
Or Amazon.
With Impact. Yes, with TNA, with Impact, what do you think is missing from them? Because they've been great for a while now. They've been able to put on great shows. What is kind of the missing ingredient with them?
They're on a skeleton budget. I mean, what they do with that, with what they have is incredible. I mean, you would think that, that they're, 25, 30, 40 guys on the production side. There's 7, maybe 8. That put all that together. They worked their butts off doing it. And it's just, I hope it gains traction. I hope maybe they could get on a different network or the network becomes more popular. The shows I think are entertaining. A lot of it was based on Scott D'Amore and the trust that so many wrestlers had in him. They would leave money on the table, so to speak, to come to TNA because they knew Scott and they trusted Scott. I don't know how that differs. Obviously, we had a few returns this weekend at TNA, so I don't know if that's going to change at all. But you know, Scott, you know, it was. I know you probably followed it when Scott was gone. There was, you know, there's big. You know, it's almost like your father, you know, got kicked out of the commune. But again, you can't change what you can. You have no control of things. So people slowly but surely said, you know, we love Scott and we miss him, but we're going to keep rolling and see where this takes us in with the new management. And, you know, from all I hear, it looks to be good. I know a lot of people still miss Scott. And, you know, again, this is a crazy business. And just when you think you have all the answers, as my buddy Piper used to say, they change the questions.
Yes, I love that. I know you and Roddy obviously were pretty tight. When you look at Impact,
I think I was as tight with Roddy as you could get. Other than maybe being like immediate family, I spent 40 days on a tour bus with him. So I mean, you get to know somebody after spending 40 days in a bus. So as his tour manager, so. But yeah, close. Roddy was kept most people at an arm's length distance. Very interesting guy, possibly the most interesting person of a ton of interesting people that I've met in this business.
That book tour was great. I was at one of the signings. Just he's like the nicest guy ever. Crazy. Hogan and Piper might be the two nicest guys I've ever met in the business. I met hundreds of wrestlers, but it's crazy that those two might be the nicest and they might be the two most famous.
Roddy is so warm, you know, he would, you know, not only shake your hand with one hand, he'd put both of his hands around it. You know what I mean? He'd pat you on the back. Now, don't get me wrong. And we talk a lot about it a little bit in the book, and we're going to talk more about it in depth then too. Because like I said, this book ends in WCW going out of business. And we got a whole bunch of bonus stuff for volume 2 that's going to blow your mind. So the bonus pages are still there and all the really cool content. It's just not WCW. CW stuff, he was paying me to do his business and to you know do a job, and if he didn't felt like I was doing the job, trust me, that warm guy went away and business Roddy came there. He wasn't like an asshole, if I could say that on the show. He just was very direct, and I appreciate direct people. A lot of people bullshit in this world. I'd rather you know what you think of me and how I can fix it. There's definitely two Roddies, and the one you saw was very warm, and the other guy was a businessman who was trying to make a living for his family and protect his image.
With Piper too, man, his debut in WCW, that was great. When he showed up at Halloween Havoc 96, it was almost like, okay, WWF ruled the roost, then WCW gets Hogan, obviously, while you're there. WCW kind of becomes obviously equal WWF, maybe a little bit ahead. Then Piper comes in. The NWO is there. That just took it to another level. I mean, then it was like, okay, there's no turning back. 83 weeks of dominance was in full gear with Piper there.
Yeah, well, I mean, about not wanting to know things. And when I, growing up a huge Piper fan, one of my favorite wrestlers of all time, if definitely top three. I grew up watching the George came, did the color with Gordon Solie and then turned babyface against Don Morocco in that famous angle. And then, when did Piper's Pit? Like I said, the two things are the interview, the promo, the angles, and there was a promo on every Piper's Pit, and on 90% of them there was an angle. So of course I was going to love that. So when I heard the bagpipes, man, that little 13-year-old kid in me, I was there sitting in a tux, hosting the event, it was so cool. Just to I had no idea, never in a million years. Would I have thought that Roddy Piper was going to walk out and do it and do what and Hulk did on that night. And it's such so cool to remember that and be there and be a part of it, quite frankly, albeit a small part of it, but still a small part.
So you not getting like any sort of like if there's a surprise, even Rat Bash of the Beach 96, Hogan's the third man, like the announcers aren't really told, right? I mean, even Heenan famously kind of says, oh, whose side is he on? So the announcers aren't really told, right? Because they want natural reactions.
I think the big mystery with the Hogan heel turn was whether he was going to come out and do it. He had huge reservations, and we go into detail on the book about, you know, Kevin Sullivan and the things that he had to do to convince Hogan to turn heel going back a year before. You know, it's actually a really cool story that most people don't know. I think everybody had an idea it was Hogan, just the murmuring around the background. But the stuff like Lex Luger on the first Nitro and Piper, Ultimate Warrior, things like that, nobody knew. There wasn't a hint. There might have been five people, maybe the director in the truck, Janie, who had to arrange the travel and hiding him somewhere, them somewhere. Eric, obviously, Kevin, obviously, and that's probably it. And that was the fun of Nitro, you know. That was when Lex Luger walked out on that first Nitro, a light bulb went off in my head. I'm like, holy crap, we ain't playing around no more. We just took this guy literally from WWE last night and put him on our TV. And, you know, this is a new game of how could I top this? And yeah, almost all of it was secret.
It is crazy looking at that because it's like, wait a second, I thought Luger was in WWF. Oh my God. And like the story behind it and how it all went down, it's just nuts when you really look at it. But that just showed right then and there, WCW not only was the major leagues, they were out to be number one.
Yeah, you know, I was there for a lot of the bad part, beginning before Nitro and after towards the end of Nitro. And we tell the whole story in the City Ringside Volume 1, which you could get on davidpenzerbook.com. And my perspective, sitting ringside, so to speak. But there had been some lean times, man. I remember when 3,000 people was a great house because we were, you know, we had all those stars. But, an average house was about 800 people, maybe 1,200. A lot of it was paper. When Savage came up before Hulk and him and Flair had the feud, then all of a sudden we're seeing like 2,500, 3,000 people. And we were like, holy crap, there's something here. So even though the Nitro and the NWO was getting credit, a lot of the beginning of the buzz was Savage versus Flair feud.
Yes, that is true. You always hear that feud was definitely picking up momentum. And obviously it was getting more fans into the arena. Then when the NWO hit, then it was like, oof, just kind of reignited the business and just sort of set the business back. I mean, it was another boom period.
Absolutely. And I mean, you think about it, living through that, 800 people is a good show with all that they had there. And then all of a sudden 2,500 people, holy crap, we're on cloud nine. Who could have ever predicted that just a few years later, we'd be selling out domes? I mean, it's just what a crazy ride that was. It was a ride. We were running hard and, just having fun and, you know, until we weren't anymore. And, that's just how things go. That doesn't the story does always have a happy ending.
Now, you were saying about the bloodline. You put the bloodline over the NWO.
Longevity. I think for longevity. I think the NWO is groundbreaking and will never be repeated for obvious reasons, many obvious reasons. But I think the longevity of the bloodline, how long they've been able to main event sell pay-per-views and merchandise, even though NWO sold a ton of merchandise, but everyone on the bloodline has a different t-shirt. They went through so many people, main events against Roman, probably went through three or four WrestleManias with that bloodline angle. And, you know, I while the NWO was successful, it was not successful for near as long. And the bloodline's not over yet. If anything, it's just starting over because who knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, basically 4 years coming up on the Bloodline. And you're right, because The Rock is involved. Now, obviously, he's a part of the Bloodline. He, one of the biggest stars ever in history of the business, cemented himself. But is there a new tribal chief? Why is Heyman's phone getting destroyed? Haku's son, Tama Tonga. Apparently, Tama from the Islanders, Tonga Kid, his son, Jacob Fatu, is signed, apparently. There's a lot to be looking forward to with the Bloodline. There's a lot more.
There's some rumors that one of the main matches for SummerSlam is going to be Fatu, Tama Tonga, and I'm drawing a blank Solo. On the guy. Solo against Roman Reigns and the Usos. I mean, who would ever see him in a year ago? And I don't know if that's where they're going, but if that's where they're going, it's pretty damn cool. And you'd think they'd get there at some point, maybe not SummerSlam.
Yeah, plus then is The Rock like behind Solo's group? Is he leading that group? Where does Heyman lie?
It's just,
it can get very interesting.
It's just so well done. And like I said, it was a viral video of Jey Uso laughing, or I never would have gotten into it. I don't want to take anything away from the NWO. The NWO was groundbreaking, and the NWO basically was the story that WCW for so many years put on their shoulders and were so successful with. But it just, I think that. Anybody you ask in upper management that looking back would say it probably got away from us, you know, too many members, watered down. It's very hard to keep an angle like that going for so long. And that's one of the reasons why I'm just blown away by the Bloodline angle, because it just keeps going and adjusting and modifying and it's drawing, you know, Jay's one of the top baby faces on Raw, who would have thought of that a couple of years ago? I just think it's probably never, like the NWO for a lot of reasons won't be duplicated. You can't duplicate Hulk Hogan turn, not even The Rock turning heel is going to come anywhere close to Hulk Hogan at the time turning heel. But this is I give the Bloodline mad respect for that angle and just how many stars it's made and how much money it's drawn and the longevity of it. Cause it's really easy to get burnt out on something like that creatively week after week, after week, after week. It's really easy.
Yeah. The NWO started to get too crazy. Kind of got too out of hand. Then they split it up into two factions. At one point it just got too much and too watered down. They didn't really book it for the long haul. They were just trying to get as much money out of their cash cow as humanly possible, for sure. But it did lead to then, of course, the Monday Night Wars, which was really leading to the Attitude Era and WWF taking off, because without the NWO, there is no WWF taking off with Vince and Stone Cold.
Look, I tell the whole story, the NWO, from my perspective in the books, City Ringside Volume 1. From my perspective, City Ringside, obviously. But I'm not trying to take anything away from that angle. That angle was freaking groundbreaking. Scott Hall walking down the stairs and making Georgia grabbing my mic and cutting that promo. You want a war? We'll give you a war. But playing off the scheme, team and all that was brilliant. That was incredible stuff that you'll never get that again. I don't think there'll be a scenario where you could get that, where Hogan turns heel after being the biggest babyface on earth, and cuts a great heel promo and it just off with the style that they of the interviews that they did and the black and white and all that. I'm not taking anything away from that. That was huge. I was honored to sit ringside and watch that and be a part of it, a little part of it. But I do think that as far as longevity, and I don't want to harp on this, but as far as longevity, I would say the Bloodline has drawn more money and made more stars over the last 4 years than the NWO did. But in that short 2 year period of the NWO, man, it was the hottest thing in the world. You couldn't go in a mall without seeing people wearing NWO shirts.
Hey, I still see people today. I was at Wawa. I saw a guy wearing an NWO shirt. So it's crazy. You still see it today.
Yeah, I do too. It is crazy. And that just shows what impact it had.
Apparently, I was reading that Steve Austin and the NWO still sell $1 million of merchandise, multiple millions each year for WWE on their online shop and, you know, wherever they sell their merch. So it's like, wow, oh my God, all these years later, and they're still insanely popular.
Well, if you look at, I don't know if it's still up there, but if you look at WWE's, I found this by accident, somebody posted on Twitter. But if you look at WWE shop, whatever it's called, they have Monday Nitro, WCW Monday Nitro t-shirts on there now.
Yes, I've seen that. And like different pay-per-views sometimes, yeah, they sell crazy amount of WCW merch. I guess it's the nostalgia of it, but very, very cool stuff on there.
They got that the Dark Side of the Ring people are working with The Rock's company and doing a docuseries on WCW. So I would assume on that they're putting that merchandise up there. And once that docuseries starts to get people interested and get over, I would assume that that stuff will start selling if it doesn't already sell the Nitro. And they'd be crazy not to put more old WCW stuff on because, you know, they're telling the story all over again to a new group of audience.
What was it like sitting ringside like during the fall? Because you were kind of saying like you've seen it during the bad era, but then you've seen it get real hot and real good, and then it tapered off. Was that like a surprise to you sitting ringside, or were you thinking it was bound to happen eventually?
I wasn't thinking it was bound to happen eventually, but I didn't really see it coming. But and you know when you're there times. You know, because we were still winning a couple of weeks a month, and then they were winning a couple of weeks a month, and it wasn't really till like the Mike Tyson and Steve Austin angle that things really blew up in their direction and started to fall apart in ours. It was frustrating, but we were still, you know, doing 10,000, 15,000 people for you know, Nitro and TVs and stuff and selling out pay-per-views. So it was a long drip, drip, drip before finally, you know, kind of realized that this is going the wrong way and it doesn't look like it has a chance to come back.
What do you think was like the death knell? People say Goldberg streak ending. Some people say the finger poke of doom. Some people rewind back to Starrcade 97. What do you think it was?
Well, I didn't know for the longest time, but I'll tell you, I absolutely know now. And Guy Evans, who wrote this book with me, Sitting Ringside, available on Amazon and davidpenzerbook.com. Also wrote the famous Nitro book, which if you have not read and you're a WCW fan or interested in WCW, you got to read it. I mean, he, you know, I interviewed with him for a couple hours, but he found people that I didn't even know were still alive, you know, directors of Turner Broadcasting that had a cup of coffee in WCW and got them to that, you know, they probably never want to talk again. Guys like, Schiller and Harvey Schiller and, you know, people like that, and got them not only to like admit that they were there, but to bring it up and to talk about it. But one thing that I learned by reading his book and then talking to Eric around the same time is that even if we were doing what we were doing in 95 and 96, we were dead in the water. It didn't matter. Ted Turner had lost power, and the people who gained power, you know, because he sold the company first to Time Warner, then I forget the other company. But he went from the boss to half the boss to a third of the boss. Well, a third of the boss isn't the boss anymore. So they didn't want it on their television. They happened to use the fact it wasn't doing as well to take it out down. But I'm positive when I tell you that since I've read that book and had conversations with Eric and Guy and different people, even if we were doing Goldberg Hogan numbers, there wasn't that the company was going away. Now, could we have salvaged it somewhere? Perhaps. It certainly gave them a fodder to do it quicker than maybe they were planning on it, but didn't have a shot. So you could talk about all the finger poke of doom and Vince Russo and David Arquette and I get to that all in the book from my standpoint, and part of that time I was like in the booking committee, so that's been part of the business that I got to talk about in the book, but But, you know, you could talk about those things and none of them helped. But it was going to happen. It was, it's called a fait accompli. It was no saving it once Turner lost power.
And if you look at it, too, Jamie Kellner, that deal might be the worst deal ever in the history, too. If you look at business deals, it's like, wait a second. They could have sold for $65 million, but they sold for $5 million. Like, what? Crazy.
I remember when Hogan heard it, you know, because I was really tight by this time with Jimmy Hart. And when Hogan heard it, and this is not in the book because we kind of ended at me walking out of the power plant and that was the end. But and then volume two, we pick up with the XWF in depth that people I know are always very interested in hearing about that because not a lot has been said about it. And and you know, TNA and Impact and all that. But talking shop of mania, COVID, all that crap. But I forgot my original point. It sucks getting old. Where was I going with this?
With Hulk saying that basically he would have bought WWE.
Oh, yeah. When he heard how much, he was like, damn, I'd have paid double. Because Hulk's a smart businessman. He always was.
Yeah.
Yep. He knew the business. You know, you could say, you know, doesn't work for me, brother. Doesn't work for somebody, you know. And I talk a little bit about my personal experience with Hulk and stuff that I saw that nobody else saw. There were no reporters there and cameras there. So, you know, nobody's perfect for sure. And, you know, he's had some falls and some missteps. But he knew of the value of all that stuff, that all that video and all that whole that tape library. And yeah, it's insane how cheap they sold it for. Probably the best, maybe the best corporate deal in the history of corporate in hindsight, looking back.
Yeah, man, WWE got quite the coup there. And I know, I forget his name. I think it's Stu Schneider or something. He was friends with Kellner, went to college with Kellner. There's some, I know Guy talks about it in the book, but there's some sort of backroom deal there that didn't seem right. But crazy to be able to get that company for that cheap when it's worth probably quadruple that amount.
Well, they had to get rid of it before Eric and his company bought it. Because if they got rid of it, if Eric would have bought it, and they, part of the deal was that they get to keep the time slot, they would have been stuck with it. So once they realized they had a window of Eric and Fusion Media or due diligence, they were like, we got to get rid of it before he signs his contract or else we're going to be stuck with it. So basically, I think they'd have given it away. I think they probably thought $4 or $5 million was a nice amount of money. They'd have given that away and shown. And, you know, people didn't know that at the time. One of the things I talk about in the book is I'm glad I didn't know that because I'd have been, as bad as it was, you know, living through it, you know, my dream coming to an end, who knows where it was going to go, if anywhere. But if I had ins and outs, I talk about panic attacks and anxiety attacks. I'd have been driving myself crazy. So some things are better off not known.
Yes, true. And it's also interesting you mentioned part of creative towards the end. You had a lot of different jobs, not just announcer. You did a bunch of different roles.
I worked in production. I produced the syndicated live house show promos. If you remember Gene, he did it in WWE too. And, you know, he'd say, you know, Minneapolis, Minnesota, WCW is coming a week from this Saturday night. And you're going to see this match and this match and this match. And come on in. My good longtime personal friend, Hulk Hogan, wrestling Sting at Minneapolis a week from this Saturday, you know, and they were inserted. And I produced all those. Talked about Chris Jericho, a really interesting Chris Jericho story in the book about that as well that I think people will get a kick out of. But I was doing talent relations. I was doing and part of the creative team. I didn't take anything for granted. There's a lot of people out there who could announce on a microphone. So in my mind, I wanted to do as many as I make myself as valuable as possible. The other thing is I never had a backup. They never asked me if I wanted a backup. I never broached the subject with anybody. And I figured just have me do it. I'm going to go to every damn show and not give anybody else an opportunity to take away my dream. So at one point I did have one when me and Jimmy and Arn and Tony Schiavone were booking WCW Saturday Night Weekend. And so I couldn't be at the gorilla position and the ring. So I did hire, but I hired somebody who I was confident would be good, but wouldn't upstage me, if that makes any sense.
Yes, you don't want somebody taking your job, obviously, but you want to do a good enough job that they're able to be on TV.
So, but for that run, almost all of it from the time Gary Capetta left in 94 to maybe 98, 99, it was just me. And I was fine with that. You know, never missed the Nitro, never missed the Thunder. I never really missed the TV taping in my entire career until COVID. A couple years ago, and I missed an Impact taping in Hollywood, Florida. Knocked the hell out of me for about 6 weeks. But that's the first time I ever missed a television taping in my 30 years of doing.
Did you ever mind that Michael Buffer would come in and do main events? Did that ever bother you at all?
No. And when I talk about it in depth in the book, but the short story is, you know, I'm capitalism. The guy came up with a line, he got it over, and he made it worth the fact that people were willing to pay $5,000-$10,000 to bring him in to say the line. And the place went nuts, and it sold the main event, and God bless him. You know, I could have tried to come up with a line. You know, my story didn't end that same way, but still, you know, I had no animosity towards him at all. He was always great. And it still to this day gets a pop whenever, but don't try to use it because he will sue every son of a bitch who tries to use that line. And God bless him, because he has to, because if one person is able to use it and get away with it, then other people could say, well, he did it. And the court then starts to go like, well, this is getting to be a really popular line. But if you police every MF-er who uses that line in some form or fashion, then they could never, then that copyright will never go away. He's a smart guy.
By him. Yep. Very smart.
He came up with a line and got it over. Super over, and he got paid for it. You know, the only thing I wish is maybe I would have had the opportunity to do the same thing, but there were different circumstances. So if I wanted to, it wouldn't happen. You didn't hear me very much on TV. And there's the story about that too in Sitting Ringside Volume 1. Where is it available, John?
Yes, where? You tell me where. DavidPendra.com.
You should know
Amazon
by now.
DavidPendraBook.com and Amazon.com, of course, as well.
Amazon and DavidPendraBook.com, yes. And there's all kinds of, I don't know if I said this already, there's all kinds of cool packages on DavidPendraBook.com where you can actually get the format. I think in it where you could get it signed at conventions and stuff. So maybe a new little category of memorabilia will be old formats from Sitting Ringside.
I think that's a great idea, because then you could get, like, let's say the main event, you get that autographed by the wrestlers, or even any guy that was on the show, on the card, the announcers. I think that would be a cool new thing. I think that's a great idea.
Could you imagine if you went to WrestleCon and got, I'm just throwing it out there because it's probably the only one they, but have Sting and Flair both autograph the actual page that the main event of the show is on. You know, there's actually a whole page, two pages devoted to it was usually a page devoted to each segment or two to the main event. And I mean, to get that, hell, I might do it.
Yeah.
I'm marking myself out.
I love it. Now, as we hit the wind down here, we head towards the finish. I know we're talking about the book. What's your favorite part of the book?
I love that Kevin Sullivan did the forward. It's such a Kevin Sullivan's first wrestling show I ever saw live when I was 11 years old in May of 1977. When he was doing his bit in Championship Wrestling from Florida, I was a big fan. There's a little known bit that he did towards the end. That's very little, you know, even spoken about because very few people saw it because there, you know, nobody was watching territorial wrestling anymore, where he sort of came out of the haze and was doing all kind of goofy things and to end up teaming with Blackjack Mulligan and his base, that I just thought was awesome. Still to this day, some of my favorite stuff in the wrestling business. And, you know, I wish I could find it so other people could see it. But, you know, and then, you know, being in WCW with him and him to kind of taking me wing in a lot of ways, you know, we'd be riding down in a car, you know, me, Nancy and Pee Wee, and he'd hand me a pad. And, you know, I look back and maybe he was ribbing me. He's like, I want the ring announcer to, you know, I don't think he was doing it maliciously. I want the ring announcer to be my stooge and write down my matches. But this stooge didn't give a shit. He would say, Penzer, write this down. Television championship match. Chris Jericho. Okay, who are we going to have Chris Jericho defend against? Maybe Abel Lincoln. No, we already are done with that angle. We don't want to beat Dean right now. How about somebody who could put on an entertaining match, but not not be anybody that's going to get heat for being beat, you know? So, of course, I said Disco Inferno because you could beat him all day long and the guy still comes back. So, and right. He'd say, all right, write down Disco Inferno. And, you know, in some ways it was, I used to be one of those guys that booked my own promotion when I was in high school. I had my own promotion, you know, sort of like what Tony Khan did. Mine just on the air and, bless him for being able to live his dream. But I was one of those people and to be able to do that and then be able to come up with matches that are still remembered to this day that were my ideas for pay-per-views towards the end, a couple in there that are discussed in the book. And I mean, that's super cool. You know, being able to work with Jimmy and Arn and Tony to book Saturday night. It's inconceivable now when you think about it that nobody really gave a shit. Like to call Eric and say, this is what we're going to do. He'd rather not know. He had 5 hours of live television, and this is not a shot at Eric. Saturday night was an afterthought. So somebody else wants to do it for you. But if you think about it now, you know, even NXT, you know, they have an Shawn Michaels is going to do in corporate. They didn't have any clue. The deal was, is we taped two shows in one night. So every other week, and we could use the young guys like the Benoits and the Jerichos and stuff like that, who love to do the show because they featured, but none of the big names were going to be on it. And so we kind of told our own stories and created our own storylines. And, Jimmy, you know, we talk about it in the book, but Jimmy used to say, you know, because we started going up in the ratings. And Jimmy said, guys, don't celebrate that. And we go, why? Because once we get too close to Thunder, we're done. And wouldn't you have it? 1 week we got a 2.6 and Thunder got a 2.7. And the next week it was a package show. But the moral of the story, and like I said, we go into more detail in the book, but as a kid growing up watching Georgia Championship Wrestling and watching every Saturday night and, you know, not missing an episode and watching, you know, Ole Anderson and Tommy Rich and The Assassin and Wrestling 2 and then the Freebirds totally revolutionized the business in some ways and Austin Idol and all that stuff. For me, I didn't even realize it until Guy wrote it in the book that I actually was part of the booking team very last WCW Saturday night. So stuff wow. like that I don't even think about that Guy, because he's so good and so detail oriented, pointed out. And I'm like, holy shit, I didn't even realize that, but that's true. So, you know, like I said, I'm beyond lucky, beyond blessed. And I appreciate, you know, I appreciate the fact that anybody gives a shit, quite frankly, if I could say that on your podcast. You know, we get into the whole story of how it happened and had so many things had to go my way. A lot of it was luck. A lot of it was stuff that in a million years back in the 80s and 90s, you would never predicted whatever unathletic 5'6" Jewish guy who had no history in the business. But somehow it came true. And like I told you earlier, I was just going to keep going until it stopped. And so far it hasn't stopped.
Love it. Tell us one last time where everybody can get the book.
Okay, if you want two books for the price of one, over hundreds of pages of rare formats, never before Forcino memos, the last Nitro, the format on Thunder where David Arquette won the world title. And that's not what the format says the finish is. When Vince Russo unfortunately won the world title. And I go into details in my book about my feelings towards Vince Russo. And I don't think Vince Russo is going to be very happy. His fans. So I'm expecting a little bit of a pushback from that, but I tell the truth and it's not personal. It's just my point of view as a, as somebody, two people in the business. But you know, you get my, you get the, all the bonus material, you get my story as well. My insight in WC living it, never missing a night show, never missing a house show for all those years. And, you know, just behind the scenes, look at my perspective of an amazing run and an incredible story, both mine and WCW's. And I really think that everybody's going to have a blast reading it. The initial feedback we've gotten, it's only been out since, you know, a couple of days ago, 4 days ago, 5 days ago. And the initial, you know, it's just starting shipping on Amazon. So the initial feedback we've gotten has been tremendous. And as more people rethink, you know, like I said to the guy when he said, we're going to do the autobiography too, I said, they'll buy it for the bonus stuff, but maybe read the autobiography and enjoy it. And he said, well, that's perfect. Because, you know, we don't care why they buy it, but if they, I want them to read your story and enjoy it. And just like I have, the guy said. So, you know, for whatever reason you buy the book, it's not going to hurt my feelings. If you wanted to take the look at the formats, it's super cool how the sausage is made kind of stuff. And you want to read my story and you're getting some enjoy my perspective and my thoughts and the people that I interacted with, then even better. Then it's double. For one book. And again, you could go to davidpenzerbook.com or amazon.com. If you buy it and you read it, leave a review. I don't care if you think it sucks. You know, not everybody's going to like everything everybody writes. I don't think anybody's going to think it sucks. I mean, Vince Russo won't like it very much, but no, he'll get over it. He's a big boy. Leave an honest review. Let me know what you think. You know, we got another one we're working on now. In some ways is even cooler because we delve into this whole XWF thing with business plans and stuff like that that have never before been seen. And the whole story behind it and where it was supposed to go and how it was supposed to go and who was involved and that people didn't know was involved and who almost got involved. So we go into detail with that and then TNA and my journey there and Impact and COVID and Bucket Shop Mania and all the stuff that came in between. So it's going to be even a more wild ride because we talk about a lot of different companies in Volume 2. But for right now, be sure to check out Volume 1, City Ringside Volume 1, davidpenzerbook.com. Happy to be on. You're the one who made this whole thing start. Didn't have much confidence that I could tell a story. And people kind of dug what I was talking about, which I turned into a podcast for 4 years, which did better than my wildest dreams ever would, and which I'm very proud of. And thank Guy Evans for collaborating on. He's one of the best, if not the best, wrestling writer in current times. And I don't say that. There's a lot of good writers out there, so I don't say that. You know, just throwing out companies that good.
Hey, just happy to play a small part in this. Sounds awesome. I love this idea, and it looks very, very good.
There you go. We'll have to talk about you in Volume 2.
Yes. Hey, I'm all for that.
You are part of it.
Hey, I'm part of the story. I better be in Volume 2. That's right, for sure. But, David, thank you so much.
Maybe we'll get you a free copy. We'll send you a free copy of that one.
Yes, sir. Hey, I want one, so that sounds good to me. But, David, thank you so much for all the time. Really appreciate it.
Sure, man. It's my pleasure. Anytime I could come on and chat with you about the business, I'm happy to. And appreciate you pushing the book and letting me plug it a million times. And, you know, I'm looking forward to more back on what people think about the crazy journey that was my life that got me to where I am. And the chances of that happening, like I said, were improbable to none. So It's really pretty cool. And as I said, thank you, everybody who's followed me. And if you want to join me on Twitter, I'm at David Penzer. You know, we don't talk politics and you know, we don't let people, you know, talk nasty about people. It's just a nice conversation about professional wrestling, old school. And of course, we'll have a lot on the book in the next several months. So if you want to join me on Twitter, at David Penzer, and I'd love to have you along for that ride as well.
All right. This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You could follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You could check us out on Facebook. You could subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron, and also check out the website TMPTEmpire.com and buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies, brother.